welcome back to Shattering This. Before we turn back to Glenn and get his take on the this all of the turmoil in the world, there was a story reported here in the SRN News that just begs to be clarified. This bleeding heart individual saying, oh, it's a sacred covenant when someone donates their organs, we should take all of the organs, and so we should move the body as opposed to sending the surgeons. What the fellow doesn't understand, and this is just so true of so many situations where people get this view that they want to promote, but they don't understand the full context of what goes on. My airplane, for example, was used just recently, and it's used regularly, to fly surgeons to harvest organs, typically hearts, lungs, that sort of thing, from a deceased individual, and they bring the harvested part back in the airplane to the to their patient, and they particularly like putting the harvested part back in the baggage area where the pressures are lower and where the temperatures are lower. But typically, when we're flying someone, surgeons teams up for this kind of harvesting of parts. They're the same surgeons that are going to put the that part into their patient, but there's a whole convergence of airplanes that bring in teams from all over the country because it's not like the lungs and the heart and the eyes and everything else is all used in one place. No, it's because of the matches and this sort of thing, this, the age, the size, the blood type, that sort of thing of the individual. The surgeons fly in on behalf of patients all over the country. So it does no good to bring the body to one place as if that's going to resolve the issue. But just like a bunch of, you know, people want to create legislation knowing a fraction of what's actually going on. Sorry for the delay and interruption, Glenn. You were going to kind of give your summation kind of these events?
Yeah. Well, you don't let them fly in organs from Falun Gong members, do you? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really, all that inquisitive as to where they're getting the parts. They won't say.
Oh my, yeah. But they have to get the, you know, organs out and get them on ice and move them out and stuff like that. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, there's a term in the common vernacular known as the ugly American, which refers to traveling Americans who are arrogant, ignorant, and ethnocentric. And this essentially describes our foreign policy to the extreme of imperialism at this point. You know, it's just crazy.
Yes. We're doing what the Delian League did so many centuries ago. The Delian League was formed by Athens because Athens was unable to effectively defend itself against the Persians. So the Delian League was formed where the Aegeans used their gunboats to impose democracy, their form of government, on all of the neighboring islands and on the Turkish coast so that that they would then have an alliance of people who would serve as a buffer and would be on the same military team to rebuff the Persian League. But what the reason the Delian League didn't survive was that you can't compel choice. And they wanted to impose democracy on surrounding islands and people, just as America is trying to impose democracy on countries like Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and you name it, and Egypt, and it doesn't work.
That's why the founding fathers hated democracy. It's the immediate precursor to imperialism. And about Russia and the U.S., I've always likened America and Russia, especially during the Cold War, to Athens and Sparta. You know, now which people is more Spartan, more stoic, more likely to be able to endure the privations of war? You know, not a good idea to, be defying the Spartans if you're an Athenian.
Yeah, you know, but I think you're right in that the Russians are far more likely to endure the rigors of war than are Americans at this point. The American military is more Spartan than any military on Earth. So, you know, we We are a little bit of both. Our military is, in terms of aggressiveness, in terms of depriving of freedoms, in terms of indoctrination to view killing an enemy as a heroic deed. Our indoctrination, our lack of freedom in our military, the command and control structure of our military is extraordinarily Spartan. And also, America now offers citizenship to a foreigner who is willing to serve in the U.S. military. There's a lot of Spartan in the U.S. military. But in terms of people, you're right. The Russians are far more able to endure a long war than the Americans are, but the fact of the matter is that the Russians have no interest in fighting this war because their country is finally out of debt. They are extraordinarily prosperous, and America is in debt and can't afford to fight the war. If America were to fight another war, all pretense of being solvent would be gone. We would bite off both of our own arms and both of our legs if America engages in another war.
But at this particular juncture, right, this very moment, if the Russians act and with blitzkrieg type speed and efficiency, they can lop this thing off and before anybody even knows what happened.
They did. It was certainly their behavior in the Georgian Republic. Now,
exactly.
I have absolutely no sympathy for the Ukraine. I mean, all you have to do is look at their history and treatment of the Jews, and look at the fact that the Jewish population in the Ukraine is dwindling at just an astounding rate. And when you have a nation that was 6% Jewish by population in 90 years ago, and now is 0.2%. And it's gone from 1% to 0.2% just in the last decade. You've got something terrible amiss in this country that is known for their grotesque anti-Semitism. This is not a group of people that I would want to come to the rescue of. There's something seriously wrong morally with these people. So it's
at least during the Soviet era, they were given the opportunity to make Aliyah and get out to Israel, mm-hmm. or wherever.
Yes.
One last thing I was going to say, in terms of the worldwide picture, uh-huh. I can still personally remember the first time in the Time magazine cover featuring the population bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the proliferation, of the human population is a problem because our infrastructure, our ability to develop agriculture and, provide food and everything is being outstripped by the growth of the population. When you couple that with the ready availability of transportation, shipping by ship and jets, and ready communication with telephones and everything, this is what facilitates the moving of production facilities to the cheapest labor markets in the world. So you've got the whole world has essentially turned into this huge cheap labor market with, being able to ship things back and forth across the ocean to manufacture things.
Yeah, I think that's a small part of it, though. I think in terms of population growth, I think our biggest issues are that swift travel have made the likelihood of pandemics inevitable, and that we're going to suffer from a pandemic that will kill millions of people within the next 20 years. I think also we have over-engineered our crops such that we're not able to keep pace, and we're not able to keep pace with diseases. There's a red rust that is infecting wheat in Africa that is out of control. So I see that crop-borne diseases that now spread and wipe out entire species because of the transportation prowess of the world is such that. I think we are going to have mass starvation in addition to a pandemic. But I think that the biggest issue of all is economic. But I don't see it that merchants are seeking the cheapest labor market as being the biggest problem economically.
I didn't mean to imply that it was, but I can see how it
is. It's a contributor. I think that economically the biggest factor is what we're witnessing in the Ukraine, which is that people have become parasites. It's what we're witnessing in the United States, that people have become parasites. They don't contribute, and they deprive, and they think that they're entitled to retirement and to medical care and to subsidies on food and housing and this and the that and the other, and that they're wanting, they're asking their government to provide it by going into debt, and that they're making themselves pawns. They're literally enslaving themselves as dependents, and I think that is the single biggest problem economically worldwide. And then, of course, you have this this great upheaval of religious intolerance and religious zeal to impose one's religious beliefs on others, and particularly in Islam. And you know, it in the Middle East right now is a wildfire that is amongst the largest contributors to the demise of humankind as we have known life on this planet.
I was just speaking to my parents last night, and what I'm saying, you know, so saying I don't know how people who don't open God, you know, can even, how can you look at this world as a secularist and have any sense of hope, you know?
Yes.
Whereas, you know, we know that as in the days of Noah, you know,
right,
coming, eventually it's going to lead to, you know, blood, fire, and pillar smoke, you know?
Yeah, but unfortunately, Glenn, the vast majority of people are the worst things become are looking more and more to their government and to their military and to their economic institutions and their political institutions to protect them. And this is empowering the very institutions that are counterproductive today. So I see this getting far worse.
Or worse yet, they're not looking at all. They are so blithely ignorant, they don't even entertain you. They look to their cell phone video games and just don't entertain the question. You know, they look, you know, 18 inches in front of their face and don't even perceive that they're walking into the light pole or off the road.
Right. It's called the normalcy, the normalcy syndrome.
The bias.
And
bias,
the normal, bias. Yeah, the normalcy bias or the normalcy syndrome is such that people have become accustomed to what they have been kind of accustomed to and cannot imagine that the world is going to be radically different than what they're accustomed to. And so they can't imagine that there will be no gas for their cars, that there will be no electricity for their homes, that that their bank accounts will be at zero, that there will be total collapse economically, that the world is going to be at war. They can't imagine the chaos that is surely coming, and it's unavoidable because they are just stuck in, well, this is my new normal. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am convinced that the single most intoxicating drug in the world is religion.
Money.
Well, no, that's Glenn there, that money is an intoxicating thing, to be sure, but... and the reason that money is intoxicating is because that it is an illusion. What we consider to be money almost everywhere in the world today is fiat, which means that the currency is actually based upon debt. And it's a liability instrument. It's a promissory note, an obligation to pay as opposed to a asset. So money really is a liability. And the only value of that liability is faith, belief system, in the economy and governance of the country that issues it. So it is faith, literally blind faith, in the value, the merit of the country that issues it. So it is, if you really understand what money is today, then you have an appreciation for it is an intoxicant. But I think that the greatest intoxicant is still religion. Now, I'm not going to argue with you, Glenn, that the reality is that ultimately nations like the United States and its Fed and the IMF and the World Bank and really throughout the world, that they are loaning more money to get people more in debt, because ultimately it's the phoenix. It is that the currency is going to be the primary tool used to unify and control the world. And that ultimately the currency is going to become worthless. All debts will be forgiven and people will say, hurrah. And all you need to do to have your debt forgiven is to sign up for this new economic currency, this new economic system. And if you pronounce your loyalty, yeah, to this, that you will be able to, your debts too will be forgiven, and you'll be able to buy and sell using our new electronic currency. But the problem with that is, the moment you do that, from God's perspective, you will have aligned yourself with the beast.
Right.
And so,
right.
That's a really bad move.
I've seen somebody quote Adam Weishaupt, "Oh, foolish man, what can you not be made to believe?" You know?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly, and that is the problem. And but I do think that as deadly a carcinogenic as the myth of money now is, and how it's going to be used as an object of faith, religion is still the most caustic thing in our world.
Right, right. I'll just like to make one more point and drop off.
Uh-huh, sure.
I've heard numerous people quote. Department of Defense study that cites how the thin veneer of civilization is peeled away within a matter of days from the moment of a grid, the electrical grid failure, and
right.
Within two weeks you're down to cannibalism within 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So like I'm not really that much afraid of the government. You know, I'm afraid of the masses of the decompensating people, these entitled people you speak of, who suddenly find they have nothing. Yeah, I've seen people decompensate,
you know, really
quickly, turning into a shivering man of tears. And this is why we're given the zombie scenarios that are so prevalent in
the
programming now.
Yeah, let me disagree with you here just a little bit.
Okay.
And kind of really, it's a perspective sort of thing. It is apparent that the system that we have established of communications, which manages all of the grids, whether it be power grid or communications grids in the country, are susceptible to one EMP device. In fact, they're even susceptible to one significant solar storm, where the very fabric now of society could be turned off. So that your credit cards are useless, so that your internet communications are useless, so that your phone communications are useless, and it could be turned off in a matter of seconds. So that you go from
Harrington event, yeah.
Right, you go from knowing and having access to your funds in a bank to not having access to them, to your credit card working, to it not working, to the store being able to process a sale, to not being able to process a sale, to you being able to buy gas for your car, to you can't buy gas for your car, to you being able to call your relatives and family, to you not being able to do that, for you not to get your television, it won't work either. And so we are, in a matter of seconds, an EMP pulse, whether it's from a solar flare or from a weapon or from a really hostile bug in terms of cyber espionage, shuts down the world. Now, when that occurs, and I think it is likely to occur, I do think you have to be worried about your government. And that's the only place that I want to disagree. And that is because I think what you're going to witness is what we witnessed in North Korea, where if you're part of the army of gun-toting individuals on behalf of the government, whether you're in the military or in the police, you'll be fed. You'll get what you need. But no one else will. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about the world as it's going to become. And I wanted to make two points, Glenn, and let you feel free to refute either of them. I don't think one of them is you're going to challenge, but you may choose the other. Is that I do think that the promise to those in the military and the promise to those in the FBI and the CIA and the various forms of police is that they'll be fed. They'll get their bullets. They'll get their food. But it's the rest of us that will be deprived. So we should be concerned about it. Yeah, we should be concerned about the government. We're going to be the zombies to be shot at and considered the enemy. And feel free to challenge that if you disagree with it. But
I'm in agreement. I was maybe perhaps I was a bit too categorical was just that merely, I'm not merely afraid of the government. But
right.
Certainly,
correct.
You know, without a doubt, eventually, you know, a draconian crackdown, you know, will gain the upper hand, but
right.
At least initially the chaos ensues and then the crackdown comes. You know,
yeah, but the part I want to agree with you here is that if you think that owning a gun, you're going to be able to protect your fortress home. And if you think that, okay, you know, I bought this freeze-dried guy's food, and I have a month's worth of food, and I have a month's worth of water, and I have a month's worth of batteries, and so I'm going to, with my bullets and my food, I'm going to protect my family, and the rest of you out there can starve.
That is not going to work
because if you are known to have food and other people are starving, they're going to come steal it. And so it won't do you any good. Ultimately,
I retire into the presence of Yahweh. You know, Yahweh just says, I'll go prepare a place for you that where I am, you may be also. You know,
yeah, there you go.
You know, that's my retirement. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm not hell bent on, you know, staying in this world and keeping this, you know, body alive forever. I'm trusting God.
Correct. That's why we do the program the way we do it, is we want to get more and more people to realize they ought not trust their government, they ought not trust their religion, they ought not trust their bank, they ought not trust themselves either, and that there's only one trustworthy offer here that will get you through what is surely to come, and that's Yahweh and his covenant. And so that was the point that I was going to make, is that ultimately this all leads to one place, and the one place is that the things that we're talking about here are inevitable, and they're not very far out. We're talking about 10 to 15 years, and the world as we know it will not even resemble what we are witnessing today. It will be vastly worse.
I'm interested in an eternal retirement in the presence of Yahweh,
yes.
not temporal sustenance in the Superdome under the auspices of FEMA.
There you go. There you go. You know, I rather like Yahweh. He seems like the ultimate dad to me, and I am looking forward to going off and exploring the universe. Yesterday, last night, for about 2 hours, I watched Discovery Channel, maybe a science channel, but the presentation was on the universe and showing just how remarkable and how large this universe is and all the just amazing things that we'll be to see and to explore. And that looks to me to be a whole lot more interesting than trying to ward off the machinations of evil men depriving other men and women of sustenance.
Right, exactly. So, one last quick pronunciation question for you. The main answer
is
case.
Yes.
Best case pronunciation for Yosha's name. Sometimes I'm hearing an E-O diphthong, other times I'm hearing just an O. And unlike the Messianic Jews who say Yeshua, who put a U-A in an image, you just do the A. Sometimes I'm hearing the E-O diphthong like Yahusha, and sometimes Yosha. Which is your best?
First of all, I think you know this, that my diction is probably among my greatest weaknesses. So I always do this show with some fear and trepidation because I am not disciplined as it relates to my diction. My only contribution is that I've been given the capability of connecting things that other people don't seem to see as related, and therefore can provide a perspective that's more understanding based than it is knowledge based. But I am not one who is ever going to say that my diction should be emulated. Now that said,
I'm just being completely earnest.
I know. Okay. Here's all right. Okay. So here's the best that I know is that as it relates to the first two syllables, it is definitely Ya-O, and the problem here is that there has been so much corruption over time that there are some names that we have this tendency to, like Yahuda, to pronounce Yahu as opposed to Yahuda. But every word that we in Hebrew that we know that there was no reason whatsoever to corrupt the sound that has been passed down to us by mouth to ear. for generations, in every single one of them, the wa is pronounced as an o. For example, Torah is a wonderful example. The most commonly used Hebrew word of all time, shalom, is another example. And so it's definitely ya-o. And
it's not a diphthong. The two letters aren't combining to make the yao sound. It would actually be like you would have Yahweh. It would really be like ya-osha.
Yes, correct.
That's what I was wondering. Why
yes,
is
it? It is. It is. It is. It is two. It is the yod is the is very similar to the English consonant vowel, and so would be like the y and yes. The hey, which is the second letter of both Yahweh and Yahusha, is a vowel. It is the ah sound, so it's Yah. And then the wa is definitely an o. And I know that the approach that you're taking to this is, you know, you recognize that I've taken the time to look at the entire Hebrew lexicon and every word that contains these letters and how are those letters pronounced. And if you take the time to do this, you don't have to be smart. You just have to be willing to invest the time. What you find is that the three vowels, one of which is repeated in Yahweh's name, are definitely Yah, E, Ah, O, Ah. And so now in the case of Yahusha, after you have the Yah-O, which is identical to Yahweh's name, the Shah is from Yasha. It's a contraction of Yasha. Yasha is the Hebrew verb meaning to save. To deliver and to save. And so, Yasha, the SH sound in Yasha is from the Hebrew shin, and the sound is from the Hebrew ain.
And it's uah, but it's never uah.
No, it's not uah. It's not uah.
Right, so that's clear. But the problem I was having was with that, like the A-O, but it's not a diphthong. The two vowels do not combine to create the new sound, ow. Ow. It would actually be more like Yahusha, stop in there, Yahusha.
Yeah. Yeah, now let me add one other potential wrinkle in all of this. There is some evidence. You know, first of all, if you look at the Masoretic text, 220 times that you find the name Yahusha, it is written as Yod, He, Wa, Shin, Ain. And there's two times where there is where the last syllables are, rather than Sha, are Shua. And the Shua is a different verb. It means to cry out. And so it would be, and it's used twice. Yahweh, if it was to call out that which is Kara, then that would fit, because Yahweh, through Yahusha, is calling us out of this world. But to cry out, there's a couple of times where it fits, where, you know, he's on the upright pillar, and he's, so there's a couple of times where it fits, but it doesn't fit very often. Now, the issue here, and I just love to throw everything out and let people investigate the evidence and come to their own conclusions. There's a couple of individuals who are active in the Yare Yah Forum, who have done a review of a database that claims to be based on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And if you search the database, it shows a number of places where it is Shua, as opposed to the Masoretic Yahusha. And so they've at least thrown it out to say, you know, that's worth considering. Thus far, I've only seen one of the Qumran scrolls where they actually have a picture of the name written, where it is written in a manner that you'd say, I'm not really sure what that is. The handwriting in this particular case is really bad, and it's difficult to know what was actually written, but it's at least enough to say, you know, it's worth considering. As I studied it, and it's primarily talking in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms of Yahusha, the Ben Nun, the son of Nun, the son of the Perpetual One. So it's referencing the person that whose name's been corrupted to Joshua, Yahusha, Ben Nun, the one who took over for Moshe. So while it is referencing him, he is the prototype, and it's the same name that was given to Yahusha ben Yahweh.
Of which many studious Christians are aware of that. But still, they don't even attempt to correct that. Even Joshua would be better than Jesus, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
and they know it's the same. They know it's the same name.
I know. I've prayed about that as time.
How can they be the same name and pronounced so differently? And of course, there are lots of reasons for that. One is that that a name like Yahweh and Yahusha, particularly Yahusha, that ends in with an A, is feminine in Greek,
right.
And so it would be a woman's name in Greek, and so. That was part of it. It was changing it to Us, to give it a masculine sound to it. But it's not a Greek name, so why would you carry on the Greek masculine change when it's a Hebrew name? It's utterly absurd.
Jadis, I've often wondered that.
Yes, indeed. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I don't want to miss, even though we only have 6 minutes left in this particular segment, going into the errors of the Seventh-day Adventists. Here they, like Christians in general, want to establish the Torah as the law of God as opposed to his teaching. And then they see that law as is completely summarized in the Ten Commandments, even though there are no commandments. And then they want to summarize all of that as to a single statement and nebulous concept of love. So here they go. It says, the great principles of God's law are embodied in the Ten Commandments and exemplified in the law of Christ. They express God's love, his will, and his purpose concerning human conduct and relationships, and are binding on all people in every age. They get all of this wrong. You know, the Torah is not a set of laws. It's guidance from our Heavenly Father, not laws to be obeyed. There's not even a Hebrew word for obey. Glenn, you've listened to this program and read some of the studies of Yahweh's testimony. I think you're aware that there's only one of the 10 statements etched on those two tablets that was written in the imperative mode. So there's only one of them that could even be considered a commandment.
Right, right. I understand it. But, I'm still wrestling a bit with this concept because and this whole concept of the imperative mood in the Hebrew, because in the Torah and the Prophets and the Psalms, mm-hmm. And Proverbs and the Tanakh and everything, there are clearly specifications. For example, that God issues as instructions to do things a certain way that, you know, mm-hmm. sort of have an imperative tone to them. You know, like when you build the tabernacle, you know, make it the thus and such dimensions of this material and mm-hmm. adorn it this way, where these are clear, you know, instructions which,
right.
which are imperative in nature, linguistically speaking. So I get what you're saying. I'm just not, have a lot more reading to do before I totally get that.
Yeah. Yes, what's interesting, by the way, on the imperative mood is that the vast majority of the time the imperative mood is deployed, it's not in an imperative statement. It is deployed as as an expression of volition. In fact, if you look at any Hebrew tome on grammar, they will quickly say that while the imperative mood can express a command, it is used primarily to express volition, which means the will or the desire of the speaker. So even when it's used, you have to look at it that way.
When Noah says transport the ark on mm-hmm. poles, and you transport it on a cart with wheels and it falls and gets somebody killed, that's pretty imperative to me. You know, I think you haven't done what you were told and it led to a consequence. So I'm still wrestling with this whole imperative mood thing.
Yeah, you know, and it's worth considering. And by the way, very few of Vyas' instructions are written in the imperative. Very few.
Right.
In fact, that's why I was saying that the 10 that are considered commandments, only one of the 10 is written in the imperative mood, and it's the one that is the most prone to choice and the least prone to being a command. It happens to be choosing to value your mother and father, and he's not speaking of our earthly mother and father, but instead, right, exactly. And so there are very few places that are where there is an actual command written in the imperative, and in almost every case it expresses the desire of the speaker or of the option of the object of the instruction and them being able to embrace this as a in the sense of free will. For example, I'm sure you have taken the time in your investigation to discover that there really is no Hebrew word that means obey. That when you read obey in an English translation, it is a corruption of the Hebrew word shama. And shama means to listen. And it's, you know, to get from listen to obey is a gargantuan stretch. There are, however, so that there's no misunderstanding here and to agree with your perspective, there are at least five instructions from Yahweh, which we either accept or the consequence is that we are excluded from having a relation with him and being saved by him. So when he, for example, talks about the five requirements to participate in the covenant, well, we are free to reject them, and there is no obedience here. If we don't accept them, if we don't embrace them, if we don't agree to them, then the consequence is we can't engage in a relationship with him, and we can't spend eternity with him. We'll be back after the break.